We are looking at the life and legacy of a major figure in Wisconsin politics, William Proxmire. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. During an almost 40-year career in politics, he was called a maverick, a quintessential senator, a carpetbagger, a lightweight. Do you remember Senator Proxmire's tenure in Congress? Did you support him? Why or why not? Did you ever shake hands with Senator Proxmire? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. Jonathan Kasparek is a history professor at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha and the author of several books on state history. His new book is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate, and he's joining us from our Milwaukee studios. Jonathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
So for those who weren't around or of voting age during Senator Proxmire's tenure, give us an introduction. Allow people to shake his hand.
Proxmire was one of the most important politicians in the state for about 40 years. He comes from a very unlikely background. He was called Carpetbagger because he moved to Wisconsin to start a political career and ran for office about a year after he arrived. He served one term in the state assembly. Then he is most famous for being a three-time loser. He ran three times for governor in 1952, 54, and 56. And then in 57, he was elected senator to replace Joe McCarthy, who had died. So, and he served in the Senate until 1989.
And so he moves from Illinois to Wisconsin. He had a really interesting path at the beginning of his career. He went from a very quick time on Wall Street to Army basic training to the newsroom. Tell us about that journey. What about his background drove him to public service?
He wanted to be engaged in public service somehow, and he had a hard time, I think, figuring out what he wanted to do. The Wall Street banking was very unsatisfying, so he decided to go into public service, either newspaper reporting or being a politician. He tried being a newspaper reporter. He wasn't very good at it. He tended to write very inflammatory articles, and he clashed with his editor. So he really needed a career where he could be his own person, and politics was perfect for that.
And he came from an Ivy background, Yale. He also went to Harvard?
Correct.
So what about that, being around finance, impacted where he would go and what he was thinking? Because in the Army, too, he was working with some people who were mathematicians and cracking code.
He was really interested in that kind of analytical thinking. And when he is elected senator, one of the things that the people really remarked about him is that he could bring that analytical sort of mind to congressional hearings. He asked great questions, he asked appropriate questions, and he sort of could tie everything together. He could make connections that a lot of other politicians failed to do.
Before we really launch into his career and legacy, let's talk about his campaign style. You call it legendary. What was unique about Senator Proxmire's attempt to earn votes?
It was tiring and exhausting for anyone who tried to keep up with him. He was also an athlete and had boundless energy. So he decided that the best way to win election was to meet as many people individually as possible. So, for example, when he runs for the assembly, he knocks on every door in his district. He follows up with a phone call or a postcard or another visit, and everyone got to know him. When he's running for governor, he travels all over the state, and rather than speaking at rallies or large gatherings, he went to factories at 6 a.m. to shake hands with workers who were arriving for work. He goes to shopping malls, main streets, taverns. He even showed up at an auction one time and started bidding on items. So he tries to meet as many people as possible and make a sort of one-on-one connection. So when you went into the voting booth on election day, you could look at his name and say, "Hey, I met him."
You felt like you had more of a personal connection to him because you had been face to face with him. He had so much exposure there on the street.
Exactly.
So he also was incredibly frugal and ran his campaigns very frugally. What do we know about that piece of him? Why he was such a penny pincher?
That's a good question. And I think he just by nature was frugal. And even in his college days, he was voted the biggest mooch by his classmates. The spending of his campaigns is really a great story. And it didn't happen at first. When he first was running for governor, he is spending a lot of money on advertising and TV time and radio. He's one of the first major Wisconsin politicians to really invest in media, in addition to the one-on-one contact. But he traveled cheaply himself. So there's this great story about him staying at YMCAs because he didn't want to pay for a hotel. And when the YMCA was full, he actually offered to split a room with someone else to save money.
Oh, my goodness. And he paid for his own airfare between Washington and Wisconsin.
He did. Senators got some allowance for travel, which he quickly went through because he came home every weekend. It was very rare for him to remain in Washington when he could be in Wisconsin somewhere.
Talking with Jonathan Kasparek. He's a historian, author. His new book is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you ever meet Senator Proxmire? Tell us your story. What questions do you have about his legacy in politics, about his life? What do you wonder about Wisconsin's impact on our nation's laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, he also, he would take on these working class jobs for a day, spend a day on the job with constituents. What about that tactic and how he was working shoulder to shoulder with some of the, you know, country's poor?
He started doing that in the 1970s. And a critic said it was a stunt, but I think really he was genuine in his interest and wanted to see what people's lives were like. I mean, one of the realities of political life is it tends to remove those people who are supposed to represent us out of our lives. And he wanted to make sure that he kept in touch not only with individuals and his constituents, but with what their life was like. So he would work on a dairy farm for a day. He worked on a garbage crew in Fond du Lac for a day. He did all kinds of things.
Canned peas, washed dishes. Yeah, and this was happening on his holidays, on his breaks from the Senate, doing these activities. And it made me start to wonder, how much time did he actually spend at home?
Well, that was really hard on his family life. And he was a very devoted father, and he spent as much time as he could with his children and his stepchildren. But it did get to be a strain on family life, and he was absent a lot.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Scott in Baraboo. Hi, Scott. What's ringing a bell here? What are your remembrances?
Funny story. When I was around 7 or 8 years old, so back in 1977 or 78, we lived just east of Wisconsin Dells, and Senator Proxmire must have been traveling, if I remember correctly, between Sheboygan and somewhere else to go on his meeting tours. Well, he and his driver ran out of gas in front of our house out in the country, and we're cooking supper, and up comes this guy knocking on our door saying, "Hello, I'm hauling the senator, and we're out of gas. Can you help us?"
Oh, that's brilliant. So what happened? How did you fill him up?
We were farming, so we had gasoline. We provided him with some gas, got him on their way, and then a couple of weeks later, maybe a month later, received a big headshot of him signed, you know, to Gary and Scott, "Thank you so much for your help and warm regards, Bill." It was funny.
Scott, do you still have that headshot?
It's funny because I was talking with someone about that probably a couple of months ago, and I have to dig through some old paperwork to find it if I do have it, yeah.
Oh, that's great memorabilia. You should really find it.
Yeah.
That's such a great story.
It fit right in with what you were talking about, how much he was out and about and meeting people. So, yeah, just sparked a memory.
Well, thank you for that. Jonathan, what about that running out of gas and walking up to someone at their farm door?
That sounds like him. When he traveled around, he didn't travel with an entourage. He usually had a local person be his driver for the weekend. And maybe he was too cheap to stop for gas. I don't know.
So volunteers were driving him from town to town. He didn't really travel with staffers. He just kind of did things on his own.
He did. He wrote his own press releases often, and he would just go off on his own. He didn't feel like he needed handlers or advisors.
The book is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. We're talking with Wisconsin historian and biographer Jonathan Kasparek, who is guiding us through the life and legacy of William Proxmire. What questions do you have about his legacy in politics? What do you wonder about Wisconsin's impact on our nation's laws? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us for this hour's conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a major figure in Wisconsin politics, Senator William Proxmire. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Proxmire was known for his frugality, as we've been talking about, in his personal life and in his re-election bids. Volunteers drove him from town to town. There were no ad buys. He rarely traveled with staff. And he made his own breakfast at budget motels.
One of the great things that I've been able to do is to get elected in the last two campaigns, 1976 and 1982, without accepting any contributions at all and spending less than $200 in each campaign.
Senator Proxmire established the Golden Fleece Award, which highlighted wasteful government spending. What are your thoughts on how Wisconsin's current lawmakers approach similar issues today? Join in at 800-642-1234. Historian and author Jonathan Kasparek is with us from our Milwaukee studios, and his biography is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. Jonathan, Proxmire was elected to the Assembly in 1950, and he was in the minority, and many of the legislative issues he campaigned for were voted down by large margins. And this two-year term cemented his passion for certain issues like lobbying and taxation. How did that experience in the Assembly shape his views going forward in the Senate?
It really did shape his views, because what he saw in the Assembly, particularly with these two issues, lobbying and taxation, was that the government was controlled behind the scenes by big interests, manufacturing interests and so forth. So what he wanted to do was to try and raise these issues publicly, particularly with taxation. He saw it not as a matter of low taxes versus high taxes. For him, it was really a matter of tax fairness. The state has certain expenses it has to pay for. What is the fairest way to distribute that cost among taxpayers?
And how did he do that through legislation, or what did he back that allowed you to see that fairness trying to shine through?
He introduced a couple of tax measures. He introduced some anti-lobbying legislation. None of it went anywhere, of course, because, he, as you said, he was in the minority, a very small minority. The Democratic Party in the early 1950s was very small and very weak. It was in the process of rebuilding, but at the point where he's in the Assembly, he just can't get anything passed.
Why was he so critical of lobbyists?
He saw lobbyists basically as giving certain groups in society an unfair advantage. Regular working class people didn't have people in legislative chambers lobbying on behalf of them for their interests. So he thought that a politician's role should really be an advocate for his constituents, for the taxpayers, and stand up to the lobbyists.
And he was elected to the Assembly just a few years after moving to Wisconsin. He, as we had mentioned earlier, wasn't born here. How did that outsider status perhaps hurt his political ambitions?
It was easy for him to be called a carpetbagger. That is, someone who wasn't a real Wisconsinite. And I think part of his effort at going door to door and meeting everyone in his district, and then later with his statewide campaigns, traveling so much, is largely an attempt to try and overcome that image and be the person that everyone knows and become a local in a way.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Dan joining us from Drummond. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. I actually never met him. But for some reason or other, he loved the little town of Millen, Wisconsin. There were people there at, there was a restaurant called Mary's Beehive. And he would go in there, and that's where he would talk to the different politicians that were in the area. He was great friends with the mayor at the time. And the mayor at the time was a Robert Verbee. And he was also behind getting the Apostle Islands into a national lakeshore.
Dan, thank you so much for the call. So very much up there in northern Wisconsin making a presence as well, Jonathan.
He did. He traveled all over the place. Mellon, I think there's a little unincorporated place called High Bridge, and he was famous for issuing a press release from High Bridge, Wisconsin, which no one had ever heard of.
How thorough are his scrapbooks, are his archives, as you dug into them? Does Mellon show up? Do some of these tiny towns show up?
He has itineraries for all of his campaigns, so you can sort of trace his route around Wisconsin. The papers in the State Historical Society are immense. It's over 200 boxes of materials. His campaigning files are the most interesting because it's like following an itinerary. In the winter of 72-73, he decides that he's going to take a 1,200-mile walk around the state, or I should say run around the state. And you could trace his route from where he starts to where he leaves off. He goes about 30 miles a day through these little small towns, and he's very excited to meet people in these small towns.
Well, and he's also doing two things at once. He's doing his physical exertion, and he's also shaking hands. I mean, that's probably great multitasking.
It is. The physical fitness thing is absolutely crazy. He decided that taking the bus to work every morning was taking too long, so he could get there faster by running. So he starts off he's about 50, and he decides that he's going to run 5 miles to work and then run 5 miles home. And that's after doing 150 sit-ups.
Let's go to Dick now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. I shook hands with him at Camp Randall, late 70s when he was running.
How old were you? What was that like?
Oh, it's cool. I was in my early 20s. It was an interesting time, too, because we had three senators. We had our next-door neighbor, Hubert Humphrey, and then you had Gaylord Nelson and him.
Do you remember him being quite visible, readily out there, like at Camp Randall?
Oh, yeah. He right at one of the entrances down by the field house, shaking hands.
Dick, thank you so much for the call. Jonathan, I mean, that's another place, Camp Randall, where he knew throngs of people would be going to, where he could get a lot of exposure.
Yeah, I don't think he ever missed a home Badger game. He was also at Packer games in Green Bay and in Milwaukee. He was everywhere. He's most famous, I think, for being at the flower show at the State Fair.
We're talking with Jonathan Kasparek. He's an historian, author, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Senator Proxmire's legacy in politics? And what do you wonder about its impact here in Wisconsin and on our nation's laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. So for better or for worse, one of Wisconsin's most noteworthy senators, Joseph McCarthy, infamous for the anti-communist Red Scare of the 1950s, Proxmire eventually replaces McCarthy in the Senate. But before that, Proxmire really fought against McCarthy's tactics with other Democrats. Tell us about that time, about McCarthy's rise and the resistance to it.
It was a really interesting time in Wisconsin. McCarthy, of course, makes his national reputation by these wild assertions with absolutely no evidence about communists in the State Department and elsewhere. And it becomes a rallying point for Wisconsin Democrats. And this is mostly the Madison-based Democratic leadership. So these are people like Gaylord Nelson, like James Doyle, and others who really take on McCarthyism and try and use McCarthy as an issue to encourage people to vote Democratic. Proxmire becomes part of that, too. They had what was called the Truth Squad, where if McCarthy was appearing somewhere in the state, a group of these Democrats would be nearby telling the real story.
And then after just one term as a member of the Assembly, Proxmire runs for governor. Why did he make that choice? What do we know there?
The first time he runs for governor in 1952, he was running against Walter Kohler Jr., who was a very popular governor, a very moderate Democrat who was very uncomfortable with McCarthy. And Proxmire is in some ways sort of like the sacrificial lamb. The Democrats know that there's no way that they're going to win the governorship in 52, so no one is really excited about running. Proxmire is willing, and he's willing to put the time and the effort into it. He loses by a wide margin, but he sees it as the first step. And he's really thinking of it as a long game, where the first couple of times he would run for governor and he'd mostly raise issues and meet people and get name recognition, and then eventually he'd be able to win.
Well, he lost three times, and he really went above and beyond while campaigning. He had some personal setbacks. The editorial pages suggested that the three-time loser was done in politics. What did he turn around here? What did he learn from those losses?
In 1957? Yeah. Well, he takes the three-term loser label, and he wears it as a badge of pride. And he says, yeah, I'm a three-time loser, and I want all of the people who in life who are three-time losers to vote for me, because I know what it feels like to lose and get up and try again. So he had that sort of indefatigable, I'm going to rise up in the face of adversity, and I'm not going to let this set me back too much. And I think that really attracted people.
We're talking about Wisconsin's longest-serving U.S. Senator, William Proxmire. The new biography is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. And author and historian Jonathan Kasparek is our guide, welcoming your thoughts throughout the hour at 800-642-1234. Did you ever, on occasion, meet Senator Proxmire? What is your story? What was that like? What questions do you have about his legacy in politics? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. News is coming up next, and then we'll continue to look at Proxmire's life and his movement toward the right on social issues. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Wisconsin's longest-serving senator, William Proxmire, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Proxmire did not miss a single roll call vote in the Senate between 1966 and his retirement in 89. And as the U.S. slid into recession in 82, Proxmire grew increasingly critical of President Reagan's economic proposals. We're looking at his career through the decades with your insights, your remembrances along the way at 800-642-1234. Senator Proxmire championed consumer protection and farmers' interests. What do you think needs to be done in those areas today? What in his legacy speaks to you? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan Kasparek is a history professor at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. His new biography is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. So, Jonathan, Proxmire's run for governor several times allowed him to build his platform, his brand. He was always there in media appearances. How did he end up running for the U.S. Senate?
He thought his career might be over after his third loss and expected to retire perhaps to a quieter life, or at least that's what his family expected. And then Joe McCarthy died very suddenly in early 1957, and Proxmire decided that he was the best candidate to get that Senate seat. It was an important seat because it would ensure that the Democrats retained a majority in the United States Senate.
Was it surprising he was making such a leap?
I think people who knew him well knew that this was an irresistible opportunity. And he was probably really the best hope for the Democrats to get this seat. He was, you know, he had done better than just about anybody else running for statewide office. So he was sort of the logical candidate. He didn't need much persuading. His wife, Ellen, needed a little bit more persuading that this was a good idea.
He did unexpectedly well in rural Wisconsin for his first Senate election, carrying 56 counties. Why did farmers turn out for him?
This was a big development, and traditionally the rural part of the state, particularly the north and west, this was territory that the La Follettes had always done quite well in, and which the Democrats had kind of ignored. Proxmire, by talking about dairy issues particularly and agriculture issues generally, was able to communicate the idea that the federal government could do more for farmers. It was helpful for him that the Secretary of Agriculture under Eisenhower, Ezra Benson, really pushed a program of reducing price supports for milk. So it gave Proxmire a target, and farmers responded. And the fact that he was traveling and talking to them directly, one-on-one, really helped.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Dave south of Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I wasn't really aware of that so much, but my point was that for all the time that he spent in the Senate, aside from the dairy issues and maybe a few others, that he really didn't accomplish any really significant legislation. I mean, benefiting the state particularly. He was so critical of people in his own party that I don't really think he was very popular, among other Democratic senators. And I don't know.
Yeah, Dave, thank you for bringing those thoughts to the table. What was Proxmire's centerpiece legislation? And you know, what did he leave his mark for in Wisconsin?
Well, he's certainly right in that he was not necessarily popular in his own party. He was very much his own person, and he was not a personality like Gaylord Nelson was well-liked by everybody. But because Proxmire was always critical of federal spending, it meant that other senators were very unwilling to vote for federal spending in Wisconsin. So a lot of people in Wisconsin, Henry Meyer, who's mayor of Milwaukee, had this complaint, is that Proxmire actually hindered federal spending in Wisconsin. The big accomplishments that he had in a couple of cases were sort of negative accomplishments in the sense that he stopped things. He stopped federal spending on the supersonic transport, what eventually becomes known as the Concorde. He illustrates the development of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about by talking about defense spending a lot. What he did accomplish was several landmark things in consumer protection, especially involving credit, and then finally the ratification of the United Nations Anti-Genocide Treaty, which was a big event in 1987.
Well, going back to spending, he had this Golden Fleece Award, a monthly press release where he exposed wasteful government spending. So how did this award come to be?
What they learned from criticizing Pentagon spending is that a really good example opened people's eyes and caught the public imagination better than lots of data. So they decided, his office decided, that every month they would issue the Golden Fleece Award, which was the monthly winner of some of the worst example of federal spending. The first one was given to a university study on why people fall in love. And he issued a famous press release criticizing the spending on that and saying, I don't want to know why people fall in love. That takes all the mystery out of it.
We have an example of him speaking of those things he deemed most wasteful. And let's hear a bit.
The National Science Foundation spent $103,000 to find out if sunfish that drink tequila are more aggressive than sunfish that drink gin. Sunfish, you know, they're 150 million years removed in the evolutionary scale from people. And if they could come out to Milwaukee and gotten all kinds of volunteers for that program.
Railing against sunfish. What did we hear there?
Well, he tended to mock a lot of research. And sometimes he was a little unfair because you could single out a particular part of a study that seemed absurd but was part of a much larger study that actually did have value. So the study about love, for example, was part of a multi-year study that involved all kinds of different psychological issues. So he when he picked on university researchers, he sometimes kind of missed the point of what was going on.
We see those tactics today, don't we?
Occasionally, yeah.
Let's go to David now in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hello. I was an intern for Bill Proxmire back in the mid-80s, and I remember going out to the flower exhibits with him, and we'd put some adhesive tape on his hands and that, because he'd shake so many hands out by the flower exhibit. And I was always surprised at how many names he remembered. And Mark Murata was an intern the same time I was. I was here in Milwaukee, and he was out in Washington, D.C. My brother was a page for Bill Proxmire in Washington, too. So I don't know. My brother always talked. He said he really always enjoyed Mark Shields' jokes. He said Mark Shields could tell really good jokes. And he met Sandra Day O'Connor at the Page School and said that she really had a way of knowing how to avoid any controversial questions. You couldn't really ask her anything tough. She just wanted to talk about how nice everything was, kind of.
David,
David,
how did you become an intern? How did you land that gig?
Well, it's like every other job. You just apply. I applied with Francie, and then I learned more about it, and Fred interviewed me, and then I just started. You'd just answer the phone all day, and you'd write down everything that the people called about and answer letters.
Could you keep up with Proxmire? Did he have a lot of energy?
the whole time I interned, the only time I met him was at the flower exhibit.
Wow.
But that was okay. It was interesting, though. I remember we didn't have a robo-signer, and I remember we used to take his franked mail, and we'd put it underneath the letter, and then we'd just trace his name on. we'd forge his name on with a felt tip pen. Yeah, but we had a whole book full of letters that we could copy and then use those to send those back to constituents, and that was neat.
David, thank you so much for that remembrance. Jonathan, lots of great stories there.
Yeah, he did have a whole technique for shaking hands, because he needed to get through as many people as possible, and he had ways of avoiding someone lingering too long and trying to strike up a conversation.
He had one of the longest filibusters in Senate history in 1981 to prevent national debt from exceeding $1 trillion. What do you think today's lawmakers can take away from Proxmire's stance on government spending and debt?
Proxmire was a very good example of how a filibuster can be a good thing, because he didn't use it just to kill time. He used it as an educational opportunity, and so he kept on topic. The issue of the debt really started to worry him in the 1980s, and he saw this as a danger for the long-term financial stability, economic stability of the United States. It's interesting how being the national debt or the budget deficit seems to be a political issue, but not necessarily for the party in power. It seems like it's mostly an opposition issue. And I think Proxmire would be a little bit upset of the inconsistency among both parties of alternately being budget hawks or big spenders.
How did he help bring the military-industrial complex to light?
That's a phrase that President Eisenhower introduced in his farewell address, that something that Americans should be worried about. It was not something that was a popular issue, because this is the Cold War era and the Vietnam War was starting to heat up. So if you question military spending, you could be tagged as soft on communism, which was politically dangerous, or anti-war. And Proxmire was not anti-war at first. So what he was able to do in the late 1960s is find a really good example of how Pentagon spending worked. So the example that he fixed on was an aircraft called the C-5A Galaxy, which was the largest plane ever built.
And we're going to pause right there on that story, talking about the life and career of Wisconsin's longest-serving Senator William Proxmire, held office for nearly 40 years. We have Jonathan Kasparek as our guide historian. New biography is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. Your questions, your experiences are completely welcome through this hour. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the life and legacy of the late Senator William Proxmire, Wisconsin's longest serving senator. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In early 1998, Proxmire announced he was suffering from Alzheimer's, and historian Jonathan Kasparek writes that his announcement explained a great deal about his last few years in the Senate and his decision not to seek a seventh term. Proxmire called it a very, very difficult decision and cited his age as the key factor. He would be 73 at the beginning of the term. As you travel through Proxmire's life and policies, what stands out to you here? What do you want to know more about? We're at 800-642-1234. The new biography is called Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate, and author Jonathan Kasparek stays with us. Jonathan, as we look at defense spending for decades and Proxmire, his pushback on that spending, he worked hard to push the nation's leaders to eliminate the threat of nuclear conflict. What work did he do on this issue in the 80s?
He really pushed for the treaties banning nuclear testing and reducing missiles. He was really one of the strongest voices expressing anxiety about nuclear war in the Senate.
And so how did he raise that awareness and his advocacy in a congressional resolution to study nuclear, to study that?
Well, the new thing that people were concerned about was the so-called nuclear winter, the environmental catastrophe that could occur even with limited use of nuclear weapons. He was very good at popularizing that idea. So if he could find some angle that would fit the public imagination, he could get a lot of press and really make this issue something that people talked about.
Marilyn in Hartford says she has a picture of herself as a student at Georgetown with other students and William Proxmire at a blanket drive in the Washington, D.C. area. And the blankets were collected and sent to Palestinian refugees displaced in June of 1967. So Proxmire's social concerns did not end with Wisconsin. And he made a really strong statement about his involvement with the blanket drive. What do we know there?
I don't know about that one particular. I know he did have concerns about global issues. The best example really is his advocacy for the United Nations ban on genocide. That took up a lot of his time.
What about that ban on genocide? How did he work on that?
This is an issue that was had a long history in the United States. President Truman introduced that to the Senate in 1949, and most other major nations had signed on to it very quickly. This, of course, is the aftermath of World War II. The United States Senate did not ratify that treaty. And Proxmire discovers this in 1967 and decides that this is such an important issue, the idea that the United States has to take a stand against genocide. So he decided to give a speech every day in the Senate on this issue, a short 15-minute speech every morning. He gave 3,211 speeches before he could finally secure the votes to ratify the treaty.
Did he write his own speeches?
No. He often gave people his ideas, and he often gave feedback, but he had a very, very good staff, and their job was to make sure that he had material prepared. So they tried to keep a few speeches ahead of time so that they have a backlog that he could deliver. He never gave the same speech twice on this issue, and none of his staffers ever dared try to slip in a repeat because he would remember.
Do we know his relationship with his staff? How was he as a boss?
At first, he was not a very good boss because he didn't know how to delegate. And so his communications director had an impossible job because his boss did all of his job for him. He wrote his own press releases and talked to the press. He learned to be much better. After about 1965, he assembled a very, very good staff paid them well, and he had this stability, this core group of people that stayed with him and were very, very effective.
Proxmire was a maverick. We hear that word a lot. And one thing that earned him that reputation was his critique of Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson. What topics or issues was he willing to buck party leadership over?
Well, that was the explosive introduction to the maverick Bill Proxmire, where he challenged Senate Majority Leader Johnson in 1958 or 59. This is probably the most powerful man in Washington, and Proxmire is criticizing him on the floor of the Senate. He also was unpopular among Democrats at first because he is pro-war. He is a backer of Vietnam War until very late in the game. And in the 1980s, he actually becomes much more conservative socially. So, for example, he was pro-life and was willing to confront Democratic voters and Democratic politicians and said, this is my position and I'm not going to change.
His decision to retire from the Senate in 1988 caught some in the state and in the Democratic Party pretty off guard. What happened there? Why was that? Can you take us back to that point?
It was a big surprise, and it was kind of a mystery about why he decided to do it. And what we discovered afterwards was that he started to recognize the symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's. And he did not want to remain in the Senate if he could not be at his physical and mental best. He thought that the people of Wisconsin deserved better. And he had seen too many senators hang on into their 80s and 90s or older. So he recognized in himself what was going on and decided it was time to call it quits.
And so he died in 2005 due to Alzheimer's disease and cancer. How do we know that the early stages of the disease may have impacted the senator's chance to seek another term, even before he started showing symptoms?
I think he recognized some of the early symptoms, and people didn't see it terribly well. It was really after his retirement that people started to know that his behavior had become a little more odd, and he needed to keep notes. But he was such an organized person and such a regular person in his habits that it was a little hard for other people to notice at first. But it became obvious when he would repeat himself or he would wander off and people would lose track of him.
He also kept 3x5 cards in his pocket to remember what to do for a short-term memory.
He did. And that's really, I think, one of the things that really made him very depressed at the end of his life, is that his memory, which had always been very, very good, was failing him.
You spent 8 years on this book, and you write that before you took on the project, all you really knew about Senator Proxmire was that he complained about government spending and shook a lot of hands. And now that you've finished this huge project, what would you like us to remember most about Bill Proxmire?
I think the best thing to remember about Bill Proxmire, aside from his accomplishments in the Senate, is that he wanted to be the best senator he could. And he thought being a senator was the greatest job in the world. Serving the people of Wisconsin was the greatest job in the world. And keeping in touch with the people was the most important job that he had. I think he was a great senator and a model for politicians.
And he was memorialized in the National Cathedral.
Yeah, I think that's fairly typical for prominent politicians to do that.
What were some of the sentiment that came from that, from his funeral, from his, you know, public ceremony?
People had a lot of respect for Bill, and they remembered him as this dedicated public servant who never missed a roll call vote, who kept in touch with his constituents, who used congressional hearings not as an opportunity to grandstand or take cheap shots at opponents, but to really educate and learn, educate himself and to teach other people.
Your book is just chock full of details, so many details about the life of this colorful character. Did you find that you had plenty of archival material that you could fully paint a picture here?
Well, the papers that he left behind are immense, and there's lots of great material there. The best part of this project was the oral history project that his wife Ellen undertook. So this interviewed dozens of friends, family, staffers, and I got a really good picture of what he was like as a personality from all of these anecdotes and all of these memories.
And you even traveled to see Ellen in Washington, where she served you a tuna sandwich.
She did. It was wonderful to meet her. She was just a delightful, amazing woman, and I'm so glad that I got the opportunity to work with her.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Jonathan Kasparek is a history professor at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, author of several books and articles on Wisconsin history, and his latest book is Proxmire, Bulldog of the Senate. It's a biography of Wisconsin's longest-serving senator. Joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You heard this conversation on the Ideas Network.